Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ISB podcast. My name is Andreas Banku, and I serve as the ISB chair.
And I'm Petrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB. So our February board meeting is now complete. At that meeting, we discussed six projects. But today in this podcast, we're just going to talk about two of the main projects we discussed. The first is our project on financial instruments with characteristics of equity, otherwise known as FICE. And the second is the provisions project. So Andreas, maybe I'll hand over to you first of all on our FICE project.
Lovely. Thank you, Petrina. So let me start by giving a little bit of background to the project and restate the objectives. There are basically three objectives that we aim to pursue. That is clarifying the distinction between financial liabilities and equity instruments on a company's balance sheet, especially those financial instruments that have characteristics of both debt and equity. We also sought to address known practice issues in IAS 32, for instance, the ones that have come to the Interpretations Committee repeatedly. And lastly, we aim at improving the information presented and disclosed about issued financial instruments. We published an exposure draft back in November 2023, and we have been re-deliberating since October 2024. So what have we achieved since then? Well, the good news is we've concluded the decision-making on proposals relating to presentation of equity instruments and some of the disclosures by June 2025. We've since then been re-deliberating the classification topics since July. To recap, we decided to withdraw the proposed requirements related to the effects of relevant laws and regulations on the classification of instruments. Lack of consensus on the underlying principles was observed. So solving the concerns would involve more fundamental work that would be beyond the scope of the project, and that's why we dropped that proposal. We decided to proceed with the proposed requirements on reclassification of financial liabilities and equity instruments, subject to some targeted refinements. For example, we have to clarify that reclassification requirements would apply to changes in the substance of a contractual arrangement that do not create or extinguish contractual rights or obligations, or modify the contractual terms. We also decided to proceed with requiring reclassification of a derivative from financial liability to equity when the substance of the contractual arrangement changes because a contractual term stops being effective. And lastly, we decided to proceed with a proposed factors-based approach for assessing at initial recognition whether shareholder decisions are treated as entity decisions, subject to minor drafting improvements and clarifying the underlying principles. So that's what we've been doing until February. Petrina, can I hand it back for you to explain what we discussed in February?
Sure. Thank you, Andreas. So what we talked about in February was the fixed for fixed condition. Now, what do we talk about when we say the fixed for fixed condition? We're thinking about a scenario where a company has a derivative that says it can exchange a fixed number of its own shares in exchange for a fixed amount of cash. And if that's the case, then it can treat that derivative as equity. And really, our discussion in February was we sort of asked ourselves, well, how fixed does fixed for fixed need to be in order to get equity treatment? And I think the answer there was pretty fixed. So what do we mean by pretty fixed? I think we said that in order for a derivative to meet the fixed for fixed condition, then there needs to be a fixed or known amount of consideration and either a fixed exchange ratio or a fixed number of shares. So what I'd say is two of those three elements need to be fixed. And then when they're fixed, you can work out the third. So when we say fixed for fixed, we sort of mean fixed for fixed. The second thing that we clarified was how does foreign currency play into this? And what we said is that to meet the fixed for fixed condition, by the way, it needs to be in an entity's functional currency. But we clarified that when you're thinking about consolidated financial statements and a group company issues the derivative on another group company shares, we said as long as that's denominated in the functional currency of either the company issuing the derivative or otherwise in the companies whose shares will be delivered, then that's still okay. That can be fixed for fixed.
I like your description about fixed meaning, pretty fixed. Now, obviously, there are a few adjustments that we see in practice, and the board deliberated those and decided that a number of them may be consistent with a fixed for fixed condition. We refined the proposals on two types of adjustments by describing what the adjustment is intended to achieve or reflect. So the first one of that, which was previously called the preservation adjustments, we changed the terminology, and I remind everybody that we are really good at changing terminology. We now clarify that adjustments that compensate future holders of equity instruments is a better reflection of that term. We believe it is important to refer to future holders because the party that stands to receive the equity instruments is not always the same as the holder of the derivative. It should meet two criteria. The first one is the aim to place future holders in an economic position comparable to that of current holders after the trigger event. Therefore, future holders should not be in a more advantageous position. In that regard, it's really pretty fixed. Secondly, it should not expose the entity to additional risks compared to issuing underlying equity instruments. Again, it should basically be the same instrument. The second type, which we previously called passage of time adjustments, we changed the terminology to adjustments that are solely a function of time to clarify the adjustments are predetermined at inception and must solely reflect differences in timing of exercise and are not related to time value of money. Beyond these two, we've proposed two other clarifications. If there are multiple adjustments, then each adjustment must meet the fixed for fixed requirement. And if any adjustment fails, the entire derivative is classified as for financial asset or financial liability. Further, there are requirements for permissible adjustments that are also applied to fixed for fixed share for share exchanges. So not just share for money, but share for share.
I'm just going to clarify one thing there, Andreas, as well, when we talked about fixed for fixed that came up during the board discussion. And the reason I'm going to mention it is it was subject to some debate at the board table. And I think in thinking about what we mean by, you know, fixed for fixed, pretty fixed, I know one fact pattern that has come up quite often in the feedback as well is perhaps where you have a convertible bond, where maybe built into the terms or the fact that the amount of consideration that you might convert could include accrued interest at different points in time. And I think the scenario that we were talking about in particular was where you might have accrued interest that's based on a fixed rate. Now, I think in that scenario, what we concluded in our discussion was the decisions we're taking would include that scenario as fixed for fixed. As long as that accrued interest is based on a fixed rate, that kind of still means that the amount of consideration would be a known amount, and that would fit into our thinking on fixed for fixed.
Yeah, that's a very valuable addition. Thanks for that. So what do you think the next steps will be for our stakeholders?
Sure. Well, I think we tell you, keep listening in. We are moving through the redeliberations now well, but there are still some important classification topics to talk about. What we do expect is that we'll complete those redeliberations by the end of 2026, so that then stakeholders could expect to see final amendments on this topic somewhere in 2027.
So rest assured that even though we aim at finishing the project by 2027, it doesn't mean that the requirements, revised requirements, will become effective straight away. Obviously, there will be a transition period, and that has still to be deliberated.
Absolutely. An important consideration for us is the effective date. Okay, so that was FICE. Let's move on to the provisions project. Again, what are we doing in the provisions project? We talk about what we're doing here as targeted improvements, targeted in looking at some specific aspects of IAS 37 to really try and help companies apply the requirements more consistently and also to provide investors with better information, more useful information. So in this project, we published an exposure draft back at the end of 2024. The comment period's now, of course, closed. And again, we are moving through the redeliberations phase of the project. And at our February meeting, we talked about two aspects of the proposals, both relating to recognising provision and specifically when do you recognise a provision? And the two aspects of the proposals we looked at were two of the three conditions. Now, if people have followed the proposals here, what we said around recognition is that there needs to be three conditions in place to recognise a provision or recognise an obligation. First of all, you need to have an obligation. That needs to be an obligation to transfer an economic resource, usually cash. And thirdly, a company needs to have undertaken the activity or obtained the benefit that will give rise to that company actually having to pay, to have an obligation to pay. And it's that third condition, that past event condition, the fact that a company would need to have undertaken that activity, that we focused on in February. And we thought about that past event, by the way, specifically in relation to levies. Now, levies have created particular challenges, I think, in this project. And why is that? And I think it's because often levies, which are imposed by governments, they can often, they might require a company to pay, not just based on one activity, but based on a company taking more than, one activity or action. So to give an example, sometimes a levy could be imposed on a company, imposed on its revenue. So let's say a company has to pay 1% of revenue for all of the revenue that it generates in 2026. However, it only has to pay that amount if it's still operating in January 2027. So the question then is, when does that company have to recognise the provision? Is it based on, when the revenue is generated, the first amount, or is it not until 2027 because it doesn't have to pay unless it's still operating there? And I think IFRIC 21, that includes the requirements today for levies, IFRIC 21 would say it's the last action. So in my example, it wouldn't have been till January 2027. But we've actually had lots of criticisms of IFRIC 21 on that basis, on the grounds that it often means that provisions are recognised too late. And so as part of this project, we're actually proposing to withdraw IFRIC 21 and hopefully, therefore, develop better requirements. So in this respect, and to do with levies this month, we decided actually to add to 37 what we hope is a simple principle that will be intuitive, that will be easy for people to understand, that says when you're thinking about levies and thinking about when to recognise that, the relevant action is the activity the government is seeking to levy. Sounds simple, I hope. And we're planning to support that principle with a presumption that'll make it easier to apply. And we say that the activity that the government is seeking to levy, you can presume that that's one of the actions that are required by the legislation for the levy to be payable. So in my example, there's two activities that might apply. It's generating the revenue in 2026, or otherwise it's operating in 2027. And what our presumption would say is you presume it's one of those activities. And then a company would go along and have a look at those activities and assess, based on the legislation, what is the activity the government is seeking to levy.
And I think this example is particularly neat because it seems pretty obvious that really the activity that the government wishes to levy is really the earning of the revenue, right? You being in the market on 1st January 2027 is probably just an operational mechanism to actually not having to assess continuously through the year, have you been doing or accruing revenue or whatever. But the real activity is really you are in business and you are earning revenue. So I think that is something that we've heard very clearly from our constituents. So to your presumption, the board then had a knock-on discussion as to whether that presumption should be rebuttable. And we were thinking particularly about those cases where the legislation's terms don't really align with what the government policy objective was. So sometimes it may be rush drafting in legislation where government just put something in place that seems to be at odds with what the objective was. So if the government seeks to levy continuous risk or continuous revenue, in your example, Petrina, but the legislation only requires operating on a specific date, in your example, the 1st of January 2027, it doesn't really seem to align very well. And we thought that an entity in these cases should have the opportunity to rebut the perception. The conditions for a rebuttal could include evidence within the legislation of the government's policy objective. So in many legislations, there is a basis for conclusion, and maybe you can draw a conclusion from there. Or evidence required activity is effective proxy for the activity the government is seeking to levy. And in that case, probably, if the core objective is, I want to tax 1% of your revenues, that seems to be the primary focus. So in that case, it seems to be the evidence that we are looking into. We also discussed whether to permit or require an entity to rebut the presumption, but haven't made decisions yet. Views were expressed by ISB members, and those will help the staff to develop the recommendations in future papers.
Great. Thank you, Andreas. So we've made good progress around levies, but a little piece still to come back on whether to rebut the presumption that we've decided on or not. So the last piece of this discussion we had on provisions was to do with the transfer condition. You'll remember I said for there to be an obligation, you need to be obliged to transfer an economic resource. That was in our proposals. That was largely supported. But I think what our stakeholders said was it's not exactly clear in some situations. What do we mean by transfer of economic resources? And how does that contrast with an executory contract where you enter into a contract to exchange economic resources? So I think, and by the way, to make this real, it's thinking about, for example, a scenario where perhaps as a company, as soon as I build my plant on a particular piece of land, I might have an obligation to clean up the land, to restore the land, at the end, whenever I, stop using the plant. Why in that scenario would that be considered an obligation to transfer cash or an economic resource to clean up the land versus a scenario where I might be a company that pays to get a new right, say a new license to operate? So what makes one an obligation to transfer and another an obligation to exchange? And importantly, for there to be an obligation in this case, it needs to be an obligation to transfer. So I think in that case, what we were planning to do is we took some decisions to make some clarifications to help people work out how to make that assessment. And what we said to contrast an obligation to transfer versus an obligation to exchange economic resources is when you're thinking about exchange, it involves sort of two obligations. One, where you've got an obligation to transfer, but in exchange, you actually receive a right. So in my example, if I had to pay to get a new license to operate somewhere, that's an obligation to exchange because I'm getting a new right. So in that project, again, making progress, there are some other, details and smaller aspects of the application requirements, as we said, around levies, but also some other aspects of the proposals to discuss. That'll include, importantly, I think, discussing how we might change the illustrative examples that support these requirements. But so watch the space, progress being made.
So, Petrina, thank you for that. You said that we wanted to concentrate on two of the six projects that we discussed. For signposting, probably it's worth mentioning that we have started the post-implementation review of the hedge accounting requirements in IFRS 9, and we will soon be consulting with stakeholders. I think that's a very important point, and obviously has a link to the just recently published exposure draft on risk mitigation accounting. And the second bit that I would like to signpost is that we continued our discussions around the equity method. We discussed the impairment indicators and other aspects of impairment of an investment in associate. And we discussed the further feedback from the work that was undertaken to understand the concerns about the proposal relating to particularly downstream transactions with associates. You will hear more on this in future podcasts. I'd like to thank everyone for listening in. Look forward to next month's updates and wishing you a very good day and say goodbye from us at the ISB. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please take the time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. Please contact us on communications@ifrs.org with any questions, comments, or suggestions. You can also sign up for email alerts on our website, ifrs.org, or find us on social media.